The title of my presentation is From Vietnam to Iraq, The Continuing Adverse Health Consequences of War on Non-Combatant Civilians. I want to acknowledge that I have no financial conflicts of interest to disclose other than small amounts of royalties, and I don't believe actually they're net royalties, but for $3 entitled War in Public Health, Social Injustice in Public Health, and Terrorism in Public Health. Before I go further, I want to acknowledge two people. One is with is Dr. Victor Seidel, professor of social medicine at Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine, with whom I've collaborated on much of the work I'm presenting today and on co-editing all three books. And I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Myron Aloukian, who's here in the audience, a co-founder of the Vietnam Caucus and has done a great deal, not only these broader issues of the effects of war on non-combatant civilians, but a great deal for the people of Vietnam. So I want to acknowledge you as well, Myron, and also your contributions to this work today and to two of the three books mentioned above. Thank you. One way of looking at the adverse health consequences of war on non-combatant civilians is these seven different categories of effects, which arguably are overlapping, and indeed we could probably think of others as well. The most obvious, of course, direct impacts on health, not only physical health, but psychological health as well, the adverse effects on medical care and public health services, damage to the health supporting infrastructure and damage to the environment, the creation of refugees and internally displaced persons, and the adverse effects of being a refugee or internally displaced person, human rights violations, diversion of human and financial resources, and promotion of further violence. And I'd like to address those one by one, and with some of these, talk about specifically these impacts in the Vietnam War and the Iraq War. In terms of direct impacts on health, the figures vary, but somewhere in the range of close to 200 million people died in the last century due to war or related catastrophic events, human-made catastrophic events. And if I leave you with one piece of information today, it's the second bullet point on the slide, and that is that if you look at wars in the early part of the 20th century and earlier, something in the range of, and by the way, statistics are somewhat uncertain on this, but something in the range of 10% of all deaths during war were to non-combatant civilians. In a number of recent wars, particularly so-called civil wars, which is probably a misnomer, but the civil wars within countries in the last two decades, the percentage of overall deaths that have been non-combatant civilian deaths has been in the range of 80 to 90% and sometimes higher. Again, these figures vary, the certainty of them varies, but that's as a general trend. And it's not only civilians who are so-called caught in the crossfire, but increasingly civilians are targeted in military conflict. Children are abducted and forced to become child soldiers or sexual slaves. Women are abducted or raped or forced into prostitution for the military. There are many, many people who don't die as a result of being targeted as civilians, but still suffer a great deal. In terms of civilian deaths in specific wars, and I want to make an amendment to this based on some recent data that Dr. Aloukian shared with me just very recently, in the Vietnam War, there's something in the range of 5 million rather than 4 million as shown in the slide. Overall deaths, both so-called military and non-combatant civilians in both North Vietnam and South Vietnam, something in the range of 1 million widows as a result of the war just in South Vietnam alone, something in the range of 800,000 orphans in South Vietnam alone. And just parenthetically, Myron Aloukian and a co-author wrote the chapter on the Vietnam War and its adverse effects on a variety of adverse effects in the second edition and also the first edition of the book War in Public Health. In the Iraq War, the numbers are even show a wider range of uncertainty. Some studies say there are as few as 100,000 civilian, non-combatant civilian deaths in the Iraq War since 2003. Other studies, in fact, a study done by Richard Garfield and others at Johns Hopkins and Columbia Universities and a university within Iraq who collaborated on a study 4 years ago found that at that time, using a random sampling of households, they found approximately 650,000 non-combatant civilian deaths, and that was 4 years ago. So there's a wide range, and we really don't know, maybe we will never know, I'm sure we'll never know for sure, how many non-combatant civilians died in the Iraq War. It's been estimated that there, too, 1 million widows have been created as a result of both civilian and military deaths. U.S. military deaths and military personnel wounded in the two wars are shown in these slides. These numbers are down to the last digit. I'm not sure if, particularly with the Iraq War, whether that's accurate or not, but approximately 58,000 U.S. military deaths in Vietnam, 330,000 military personnel wounded. Indeed, the number may be much higher if you include more minor wounds. The Iraq War, over 4,400 deaths and 30,000 severe wounds, and people have said at least 60,000 wounds overall, not counting the psychological wounds that you might say, which are listed on the next slide here, post-traumatic stress disorder, serious mental health disorders that meet criteria for mental health disorders have ranged from generally in surveys from 10 to 20% among returning U.S. military personnel in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Not only PTSD, but depression, anxiety, alcohol and substance abuse, violence inflicted on family members, and suicide. I was just speaking with a colleague over lunch about the widespread occurrence of this, and in some respects, the increasing recognition by the news media of, for example, suicide among returning military personnel. I think we're just beginning to gather data on the longer-term effects on military personnel after they leave the zone of combat and return to domestic life in the United States. Suicide rates among returning military personnel have been in the range of 3 to 4 times what is expected compared to age-adjusted civilian populations. Adverse effects on medical care and public health services are profound. Not only are physicians, nurses, and other health workers injured or killed, but many of them flee. It's been estimated that, and I just see a colleague, Dr. Robert Haley, will be presenting in the second half of this presentation at the door. Welcome, Dr. Haley. But we're talking here about the effects on medical care and public health services, physicians, nurses, and others injured or killed, and many of them fleeing, damage to clinics and hospitals. At the start of the Iraq War, during so-called shock and awe, only two of the approximately 35 emergency departments in Baghdad were functioning. And even there, they were barely functioning. Physicians and nurses couldn't get to them. Power was out. Supplies were limited. And people were afraid to go out, even to the two functioning emergency departments. Reduction of public health services, which often does not get reported in the media, and reductions in medications and vaccines. As you know, there was widespread looting, particularly at the start of the Iraq War, as the U.S. military protected the Ministry of Oil. They did not protect clinics, hospitals, other places, and unfortunately there was widespread looting of medications and vaccines, and of course many other things as well. One of the things that gets overlooked is the damage to the health-supporting infrastructure in society and the environment, not only during war, but in the aftermath of war. You recall that in the first Gulf War in 1991, there was vast destruction of this infrastructure, including water treatment plants, much of which was not repaired between then and the 2003 Iraq War. And indeed, UNICEF has estimated that somewhere, now this is UNICEF, the United Nations, presumably an independent body looking at the impact on child mortality, between a year before the Persian Gulf War of 1991 and I believe these data are through 1998, when restrictions were lifted on the embargo on foods and medicines going into Iraq, UNICEF estimated that between 350,000 and 500,000 excess children deaths occurred, excess child deaths occurred during this 8-year period as a result of the war and also the embargo that continued after the war for approximately 7 years. So there are impacts on the food and water supply, impacts on the water safety and availability. The water treatment plants were not repaired in part because parts could not come into Iraq so that the Iraqis could repair the water treatment plants adequately. Sewage treatment, electrical power, transportation, and communication is affected, and environmental damage. And just to show a little bit of environmental damage, these are photos courtesy of Arthur Westing. This is a damaged mangrove swamp connecting with Linda's talk. This is a swamp damaged by Agent Orange application in Vietnam. And here's further damage. These are craters created by bombs in Iraq, which for many years and even to this day continue to hold stagnant water that are breeding grounds for mosquitoes carrying malaria and other mosquito-borne diseases. So this is just beginning to scratch the surface on the variety of impacts on the environment, including, as we talk about Iraq, the over 600 fires as retreating Iraqi troops retreated from Kuwait and set afire about over 600 oil wells and contaminated the atmosphere for some time. In addition, there's, of course, is air pollution from military aircraft of a number of pollutants as shown on this slide. Another area of great concern are refugees and internally displaced persons. Different, again, estimates vary. There are in the range of 12 million refugees in the world and about double the number of internally displaced persons who indeed may be worse off, indeed usually are worse off than refugees who are able to seek some kind of relatively safe asylum in a third, so-called third country. It's much more difficult to get aid, not only medical and public health aid, any public health aid, but medical aid to internally displaced persons who are generally in far worse circumstances than refugees. And some of the major refugee displacements are shown here, including a million people from Rwanda to Zaire during the genocide that occurred in the middle of 1994, and illustrating the fact that refugees often flee to countries such as Zaire, which are not well prepared to deal with the influx of a million refugees. They themselves are often find difficulty providing basic services to their own populations. Again here, the figures vary. Some relatively good estimates say there were approximately 10 million refugees and evacuees from South Vietnam alone during the Vietnam War. In the range of 2 million refugees and 2.7 internally displaced persons in the Iraq War. And the refugee, the numbers of refugees leaving Iraq represent the fact that at least 40% of the Iraqi middle class fled, many of whom are likely not to return at any point to Iraq, which of course makes the rebuilding after war that much more difficult, including many health professionals. Of course, there are many things that make refugees and internally displaced persons especially vulnerable: inadequate security, reduced access to safe food and water, as I said, poor sanitation, reduced access to medical care and public health services, and inadequate shelter and clothing. The next five pictures are pictures that I took in a Cambodian refugee camp in Thailand in 1980, where there were over 100,000 Cambodian refugees who had crossed the border into Thailand. I say they were refugees, although officially they were displaced persons, according to the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees, since they were not granted refugee status by the Thai government, and most of them, in fact, were eventually pushed back into Cambodia, although many of them, of course, were able to come to the United States or other third countries. This is probably among the best of the refugee camps, if you look worldwide at refugee situations, some of which have gone on, of course, for decades. These are housing units made out of thatch and bamboo, which were built by the Cambodian refugees in the camp with materials supplied by the UN and other agencies. This is a girl, 7 years of age, who weighed 27 pounds, illustrating the importance of malnutrition in this population. I actually did not recognize my one-year-old son when I came home, who weighed the same as this girl, 27 pounds at age 7. This boy had measles. measles in unimmunized populations is rampant, and once introduced into a population, spreads quickly and actually can cause a great deal of mortality. And this child was one of nine children in the camp who had polio. An outbreak, by the way, I might say that was limited by surveillance of disease that was conducted through the various medical care facilities in the camp, and the use of Cambodian health professionals, including many people who had worked in public health in Cambodia before, to mount a oral polio vaccination campaign in the camp using supplies that were provided by the UN and other agencies. And to illustrate the mental health effects, and it's hard to actually illustrate them, but this is a nurse from one of the relief agencies with an 11-year-old boy. He has a feeding tube in, but he could not see. And even though his eyes were physically normal, physicians and optometrists and ophthalmologists who looked at him concluded, and mental health professionals who evaluated him, concluded that he had psychological blindness after watching both of his parents being killed before his eyes. And stories like this were not unusual among the refugee population, including the children. Many human rights violations we've already talked about. Most of what I've talked about has been human rights violations, but just to label them as such, assaults on civilians, as we talked about, ethnic cleansing, torture of prisoners, and violations of medical neutrality, and the list could go on and on. Arguably, my whole talk is about human rights violations. A Republican president said every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. And indeed, there's a lot of evidence that supports President Eisenhower's remarks from over 60 years ago. If we look at military spending, and by the way, in preparing for the talk today, I used to have the slide saying $536 billion, but I decided to put up all the zeros here, but just to, you know, I don't think we appreciate billion. You know, we talk about numbers, and we talk about numbers of deaths and wounds and PTSD and amounts of money spent, and at some point we can't even begin to comprehend, you know, what is $536 billion. You know, think of one loved one in your life who died prematurely. And then, you know, multiply that by 10 and by 10 and by 10, you know, until we get to the 200 million people who died during the 20th century of war, non-combatant civilians who died of war and related events. So, I mean, these are numbers too large to comprehend. And I think more of what we need to do, actually, and perhaps I'm not a good example of this right here, but more of what we need to do in public health is to tell stories about the individual people, children, women, other people who have been affected by war. Nevertheless, here are the numbers of military spending. This is 3 years ago. The numbers have gone up since then. United States military spending, $536 billion. Europe, about half that. China, about a fifth that. Russia, far, far behind. Middle East and all of North Africa, behind that. The U.S. military spending accounts for more than half of all military spending in the world. Now, the next slide are old data showing the per capita government expenditures 20 years ago. More recent data would probably show, well, don't know exactly what more recent data would show. I believe that we could come up with other data from the current time showing how many countries, arguably our own country, spend an enormous amount on military expenditures and relatively less on health. In Ethiopia 20 years ago, per capita expenditures on military, $16 per person, $1 per person on health, and similarly with the other countries shown here. Potential trade-offs, people have talked theoretically that if India did not buy 20 MiG warplanes from the Soviet Union some years back, they could have educated 15 million children. If Nigeria did not buy 80 tanks from the UK, they could have immunized 2 million children and provided family planning for 17 million couples. In Korea, if they turned down the sale of 28 missiles to them, they could have used that money for widespread immunization and providing safe water for over 3 million people for 3 years. These, at one point I used to say these are theoretical trade-offs, but then there occur increasing number of real-world examples. For example, President Da Silva of Brazil, not that long ago, decided not to buy U.S. warplanes, but instead used that money for education of Brazilian people. Now, it's no accident, perhaps, that the United States, and again, some of these rankings change from year to year, U.S. still remains number one in arms exports, number one in military expenditures, number one in military technology, but and again, the numbers vary, but we're way down the list on life expectancy. Some data show that we're 48th in the world with countries like Cuba, some of the countries in Eastern Europe, and some of the many of the less developed countries ahead of us. Similarly, our infant mortality rate, not only in so-called disadvantaged populations and populations of color, although those are the populations that often suffer the most, but even among Caucasian individuals in the United States, the infant mortality rate is higher than comparable populations in other countries. If we just look at the first $500 billion spent on the Iraq War, it could have been used to achieve all of the following shown on the slide for six or more years, all of the following. 50% decrease in world hunger, a truly comprehensive global program against HIV/AIDS, complete immunization of all children in less developed countries, and meeting the unmet needs worldwide for clean water and sewage treatment. The seventh of the seven areas that I'm listing here are the promotion of violence. Violence begets further violence. War promotes the resolution of war promotes the violent using violent means to settle disputes and conflicts. And as I already mentioned, returning service members often commit violence in their own communities, including violence against their own family members and against themselves. Certainly arms sales, not only by the United States, but by other countries, fuel the promotion of violence. These are arms sales for the period 2003 to 2006. And again, the United States accounted for a substantial amount, $60 billion, all of Europe, $59 billion, Russia and China far behind. And interestingly, the vast amount of these arms sales go to less developed or so-called developing countries. Now, I want to conclude on a more hopeful note, and that is talking about what can be done to minimize the consequences of war and indeed to help create a world without war. Here are some of the things that we in public health can do to help to minimize the consequences of war, and I know for a fact that many of you are already doing this. Arguably, this session today is a manifestation of that, to document and monitor and communicate about the consequences of war, to raise awareness and disseminate information to protect human rights, to ensure that basic needs are met to populations who are affected by war, to protect those vulnerable populations, and to improve medical care and public health services, and indeed to protect medical neutrality during war. Now, many of us in public health sort of cut our teeth on this basic triangle of public health, host, agents, and environment, and it is clear application to some areas like prevention of infectious diseases. But we can take the same basic public health triangle and begin to see how we might adapt it to the creating a world without war, with measures or interventions that focus on host or people, agents, that is strategies aimed at weapons, the military forces, and the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower spoke about 60 years ago, and strategies aimed at the environment, that is the conditions in which people live. And so we can change this triangle to one in which we adapt host, agents, environment to the challenges of war. Strategies aimed at people can include promoting understandings among people, promoting economic and social interdisciplinary interdependency among nations, promote nonviolent resolutions of disputes at all levels, and developing, importantly, the popular and political will to prevent war and promote peace. We can think about strategies that are aimed at weapons, military forces, and the military-industrial complex, as shown on the slide, such as controlling weapons of all types, eliminating weapons of mass destruction like nuclear weapons, reducing military forces, controlling the military-industrial complex, detecting early armed combat and intervening and strengthening the international legal system. I might comment that military-industrial complex is in all 435 congressional districts, so it's difficult to reduce it without affecting jobs. Obviously, it becomes, and it is, of course, a political issue as well as a military one. And finally, strategies to improve the conditions in which people live, strategies aimed at some of the underlying factors that contribute to, if not outright cause, war, protecting human rights, reducing poverty and economic disparities, creating education and employment opportunities, transferring resources to civilian uses, and creating a culture of peace. And so I'll end with a Democratic president, former president Jimmy Carter, who in his Nobel Peace Prize lecture said that war may sometimes be a necessary evil, but no matter how necessary, it is always an evil, never a good. The bond of our common humanity, our shared humanity, is stronger than the divisiveness of our fears and prejudices. We can choose to alleviate suffering. We can choose to work together for peace. We can make these changes, and we must. Thank you very much.